Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, April the 27th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast. Later on, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. We'll have dispatches on the United States campus crackdown on students who are protesting in solidarity with the people of Palestine. The Yemeni armed forces have struck a British oil tanker in the Red Sea. They've also carried out other military operations against the United States as well. And terrorist attacks have occurred in Iran and Russia over the last several months due to support for terrorism by the United States. And also, U.S.-oriented structures try to reform security. The security system in the Asia-Pacific region. We'll have details on that as well. And right now, we'll take our musical interlude with the music of Dr. Nico Cassandra, some of his best, most well-known compositions. Let's listen in.
Nakangaki motema Nabandaki na kokufa Sanga zomina mibale Nazalaki se kozela Bongo na popo yunga nakinde ko apie Nakobima adie Nakei kobina nakisa sukisa Komela popo ya mpio Nabina rumba ya santima Ngai na fiance na ngai Sanzo zomi na mibale Nakanga kima zema Yeah,
Esika yokende
Diana. Tinda numero ya telephone, bongo na tinda ka, mama luba. Bongo na yebaka shiri, esika yo kende. Feliciana, pesanga adrese ya yo. Bongo na tindaka ta telegram. Nalembi maloba ya bato bakotuna kanga pona jina to balinga na ye balobi atianga na mungu nalinga kaye mingi nalula pe basi mosusa wika molingo ya solo ezali tena mokili kaka kisi na komituna eloko motemelingi bakopekisaka te mwete. Nazali mwasi motema nanga elingaka ata na miso nzambe olingisali mpona kisi te kaka se makila ya nzoto ekokana. Thank you.
bolingo ezali mpona ekolo te bolingo ezali mpona mokongo te bolingo ezali mpona moluka te bolingo ezali mpona moswawili te bolingo ezali mpona mongala te bolingo ezali ye nayebi te
Libala oyo na balande makambo baninga boyokane likambo ebebisinga motema ndenge oyo Pierre asalinga Nzambe nakoki kosala ye mabe ya pamba azuwanga bomwana nazali mpe na kelasi Ngai mwasi koya libala, kolia malamu te. Kolata se eteni ya elamba, tango nyonso, pasi na pasi. Kako meso te ekitite, soni pe na baninga. Soki na kanga ki motema, kaka te koya boli.
bakuma be toni na leo ini to vanyo yo elona moni makambo na miso baninga oya kana kinga basi na ye zongerie. Olukaki maso na nga na makambo lelo yo suki olukine molimo na ngai ye omeli mai na ntonga. Olukaki maso na nga na makambo lelo yo suki olukine molimo na ngai ye omeli mai na ntonga. Olukaki moto na nga na makambo lelo yo suki olukine molimo na ngai ye omeli mai na ntonga. Olukaki moto na nga na makambo lelo yo suki olukine molimo na ngai ye omeli mai na ntonga.
Sadi, ya bapanzana na tiyo elemo na motema.
Bono!
Na jika di motema na pesa yo, na boya kota mwa, na miso ya pato.
Oh,
Tu m'as déçu, chouchou. Je suis resté ignoble. Vraiment, je suis touché par tout mon cœur. À la Binyaza, mon amour. Ebayenga mami, ebayenga ye, ebayenga na motema eadi ye, na longoli pe motema. Tokande osala kanga iboye, ngana ke mosala yo na bare, nyakangi yo na mobali na bare, kozali komela. Kalo bakana ngai nandi makate Lavela ngai nini yolingi mama Soki mpe motolo Kobanga te Ima desi juju Je suis resté ignoble Vraiment je suis touché par tout mon cœur A la Binyaza mon amour
motema se likolo nakobanda nasala ndenge nini na mokili lokola nazali jose ya mobali nasengi mpo obatelanga mpe na chanse ya mosala yoka mama nazali mwana na yo na kati ya mokili oyo ya kisasa bana okende a mama na banda kokondo na basusi motema se likolo nakobanda nasala ndenge nini na mokili lokola nazali jose ya mobali nasengi mpe obatelanga mpe na chanse ya mosala ya mokili oyo ya kisasa bana okende a mama na bana kokondo na basusi motema se likolo nakobanda nasala ndenge nini na mokili lokola nazali jose ya mobali nasengi mpe obatelanga mpe na chanse ya mosala Mama wa motema oh oh na banzaka mama wa motema oh oh na lilaka utompe mwango na kukanisa yo utompe mwango na kulela yo epai nini mama ngo na komite epai nini mama ngo na lelite pona kuluka yo mama wa motema pona kulela yo mama wa mabanzo nalingi yo mingi ye ye naleli yo mingi ye ah mama
nalingi yo mingi ye ye nalingi yo mingi ye ye naleli yo mingi ye ye naleli yo mingi ye ye
mama wa motema oh oh na banzaka mama wa motema oh oh na lelaka utompe mwango na kukanisa yo utompe mwango na kulela yo epai nini mama ngo na komite epai nini mama ngo na lelite mpona kuluka yo mama wa motema mpona kulela yo mama wa mabanzo nalingi yo mingi ye ye naleli yo
Baby motema mwanga molukio tomonana lelo na tambali bala bala ngama kona kotuna kayo naleki epa ya majana epa yo zalaki kofutela balobinanga yo siyo bima baebe payo kenete ezongaki mabongo na mawa Komi kanisa angelo zali wasi Ngana baby motema Mwanga molukio Tomo nana Lelo natambali Bala bala ngama Kona kotuna kayo Naleki epa ya majana Epa ya zalaki kofutela Balobina ngayo siyo bima Baebe payo kenete Ezonga kima bongo na mawa Komi kanisa angelo zali wapi Nana baby motema Angel Lelo natamboli kini mwabimba Suka na suka balobinga izo bana ye Angel Ebongi opesa mikolo yeko kito kutana Na miziki ya mdisa sukita Putana, la musique y a fait sa soukita. Bangonde tobina. Kiri kiri, mabina ya mboka, mabina ya fesa ya tika. Ebongi tobina. Kiri kiri, mabina ya mboka, mabina ya fesa ya tika. Ebongi tobina.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this worldwide radio broadcast.
Loka kamaraza nangaya kene paikola kata ngaiteo Nunda na maboko, wana mama oya disenge Atuna baninga na yemba lobi ya bala ambo ya kikolo peranga
Mwaza, disenge
Welcome back, and that was the music of Dr. Nico Kasanda, a collection of some of his best-known tracks. Music from the Democratic Republic of Congo, classic Pan-African music. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. U.S. police have arrested more than 500 demonstrators during a crackdown against pro-Palestinian protesters on university campuses across the country. This took place on Thursday evening and Friday morning. Anti-riot police used chemical irritants and tasers against protesters who set up camps in defiance of police warnings from Massachusetts to California to protest against Israel's savage war against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Protesters were arrested at schools including the Ohio State University, the University of Minnesota, Indiana University, and Princeton University. At Emory University in Atlanta, police clashed with protesters, including students from other Atlanta universities, and area activists arrested dozens of protesters, including faculty members. Videos are shared on social media showing officers using tear gas, tasers, and handcuffs to detain protesters. Emory's Vice President for Public Safety, Cheryl Elliott, said in a statement that law enforcement released chemical irritants into the ground to disperse the crowd after protesters ignored multiple warnings. She said 28 protesters had been arrested, including 20 members of the Emory community, some of whom have been released. And in other news taking place in West Asia, the spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces says it has carried out new operations against American and British targets in retaliation for their aggression on the country. Brigadier General Yahya Sari said yesterday that Yemen's naval forces struck a British oil tanker in the Red Sea with missiles. Sari also said the military shot down an American MQ-9 drone in the Saada province. He added that the new operations were also a show of solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip amid the Israeli genocide taking place there. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In other news, the terrorist attacks in Russia and Iran have stemmed from the support of terrorist groups in the United States and other Western countries. Iranian Defense Minister Mohammad Razi Ashtiani said at a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Shoigu in Astana, the terrorist attacks in Russia and Iran are the result of support for terrorist groups by Western countries, especially the United States, Ashtiani said, as quoted by the Iranian news agency Tasnim. According to the news agency, when speaking about NATO eastward expansion, to the Iranian defense minister emphasized that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization members states should utilize the SCO potential in order to neutralize common threats. And finally, U.S.-oriented military and political structures in the Asia-Pacific region, such as the Quad and the AUKUS, are trying to transform the security system in the region into a U.S.-centric one. That's according to Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu. As for the Asia-Pacific region here, too, we see systematic attempts to reformat the regional security system from ASEAN-centric to American-centric. This is being done by strengthening Washington's oriented military political structures such as Quad, AUKUS, and the U.S.-Japanese-Philippines triad. Shoigu said in a meeting of the SCO defense ministers in Astana. According to the top Russian defense officials, the Taiwan factor is being actively used to increase pressure on the People's Republic of China. And with that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you need to do is go to our website, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And that's for the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio broadcast for today, April 27th, 2024. You can read the Pan-African Newswire by logging on to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week.
I'm the lover's man. I made love in my guitar. I'm the lover's man. Made love in my guitar. When I come to town, all of my women fall in line. I've got a key, all of my women do. I've got a key, all of my women do. Yes, I'm going up to my baby's door. Hush. Who is that knocking? baby. Who is that in there? Baby. Guitar days is over. Can't be loving my guitar no more. My guitar days is over. Can't be loving my guitar no more. I'm going back to the woman I had 20 years ago.
That was Detroit's own via the Delta, Mississippi, John Lee Hooker. Some of that Hastings Street music from many decades ago. The track entitled Good Guitar Loving Man. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, April the 27th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. And as we mentioned in the Pan-African Newswire segment, the situation in Palestine is worsening for the civilian population. And also inside the United States, there have been demonstrations at campuses across the country demanding the disinvestment from corporations and ties to the State of Israel. Crackdown on demonstrators have resulted in the arrest of some 500 people over the last 2 days. Let's listen to Electronic Intifada, one of the primary sources on the situation in Palestine and West Asia. Let's listen in to the Electronic Intifada.
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, April 24th. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, Asa Wynn-Stanley, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 201 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We have another packed show for you today. We're hoping to connect with an organizer on Columbia University's campus as the encampment enters its second week and more campuses join in the Gaza solidarity actions. We'll also have a discussion with Professor Mohamed Abdu, who was just censured by Columbia University. And later on in the program, of course, John Elmer will take a look at videos from the resistance in Gaza and the West Bank, as well as a series of operations by Hezbollah. But first, some of the news over the last several days in Gaza and the West Bank. The Gaza government media office stated on Tuesday that over the last 200 days, more than 34,000 Palestinians have been killed, including nearly 15,000 children, and more than 77,000 have been injured. 30 children have died from Israel's engineered starvation policy, while approximately 17,000 children have lost either one or both of their parents in Israeli attacks. Nearly 500 medical staff, including physicians, specialists, paramedics, and volunteers, have been killed, and more than 300 medical workers have been arrested by Israeli forces. The Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor says that more than 130 journalists have been killed. This week, Israeli airstrikes and fire from naval gunships have continued to pound areas from the north to the south of the Gaza Strip. Starting with the south, Israeli airstrikes on Rafah near the Egyptian border have continued unabated, while Israel threatens a full-scale ground invasion. Activist Ahmed Mahdoun filmed this video on Sunday.
So as you see, airstrike inside Rafah city. It's near the tents and displaced camps.
That was activist Ahmed Mahdoun. Yesterday on Tuesday, journalist Ahmed Ibrahim posted a video of civil defense crews and residents digging through the rubble after the Israeli military shelled a home in the Salam neighborhood of Rafah. Civil defense told Al Jazeera that at least three people were killed and four others were injured, all from the same family. On Saturday night, Israeli airstrikes on Rafah killed 22 people, including 18 children, according to reports. The Associated Press reported that, quote, the first Israeli strike in Rafah killed a man, his wife, and their three-year-old child, according to the nearby Kuwaiti hospital, which received the bodies. The woman was pregnant and the doctors saved the baby, the hospital said. The second strike killed 17 children and two women from an extended family. In central Gaza, rescue workers attempted to recover bodies and survivors after an Israeli airstrike turned a residential building into a massive crater in Deir al-Bala. In the north of the Gaza Strip, Israeli forces bombed a residential tower in the Al-Daraj neighborhood in central Gaza City on Monday. Also in Gaza City, Israeli airstrikes bombed the crowded Tufah neighborhood on Monday. In the northern city of Beit Lahia, the Israeli military issued new evacuation orders to the residents who have remained or returned there. Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights stated that this was indicative of a renewed military action and that, quote, 200 days later, Israel's genocidal military campaigns against Gaza continues unabated amid the international community's failure to hold Israel accountable. The United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, stated that Israel is still preventing food convoys from reaching the northern Gaza Strip. And according to the Gaza government media office, the impact of fuel and cooking gas shortages is particularly severe in northern Gaza, where families have been forced to rely on expensive and unsafe alternatives, such as firewood, charcoal, plastic, and chemicals. The media office added that the emissions of toxic fumes because of the burning of such materials is leading to the spread of respiratory diseases, and the long-standing constraints on the entry of fuel have also affected food production facilities, including restaurants and bakeries, limiting people's access to nutritious meals and exacerbating food insecurity. Following the discovery 2 weeks ago of mass graves in the courtyard of Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest medical facility in Gaza, which was completely destroyed by the Israeli army, more mass graves were uncovered earlier this week on the grounds of Nasser Hospital in the southern city of Khan Yunis. At least 310 bodies have been recovered so far from the mass graves at Nasser Hospital, buried deep in the ground and covered with waste, according to the United Nations. Bodies discovered by family members and civil defense crews included those with zip tie handcuffs still on their arms, others wearing hospital scrubs, women and elders, some bound and stripped of clothing, and bodies with intravenous lines, catheters, and bandages still attached, clearly patients who were executed. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reported on the situation around Nasser Hospital on Monday.
Withdrew from Khan Yunis on April the 7th after 4 months of intense raids and airstrikes, leaving behind a trail of destruction and massive graves. The teams who recovered the dead say some were shot from behind, execution style. Others were found with their hands tied behind their backs. Many more are believed to be buried on the grounds of the largest medical facility in southern Gaza.
The identified bodies were delivered to their families, and we as civil defense keep the unidentified bodies, take note of any distinguished marks for each of them, then we bury them.
Another mass grave, yet more Palestinian bodies are retrieved from this site whose names might not be remembered. Their identities are largely lost in an unprecedented war.
Lost but remembered, those who have been identified will now receive a proper farewell. For countless others, the search continues. More than 7,000 people are still missing across the Gaza Strip, most of them women and children.
That was Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reporting from Khan Yunis on Monday. The charity Save the Children reported that since October 7th, the rate of attacks every month on medical facilities and healthcare workers, quote, has been higher than in any other recent conflict globally, standing at an average of 73 attacks each month. Becky Platt, a pediatric nurse at the Field Hospital in Rafah, told Save the Children that, quote, We've recently seen an influx of children from other hospitals with wounds and lost limbs, often needing skin grafting and multiple operations. But even getting hold of simple things like strong pain relief is a major challenge. When children have to undergo a procedure to save their limbs and avoid infection, we are forced to do it with less pain relief than we'd normally use. So I brought bubbles and games on my phone to distract them, but the reality is that a lot of these procedures need strong pain relief. That is causing huge distress, and it will also add to long-term psychological damage. The nurse added that, quote, we treated a 10-year-old boy who had some shrapnel in his thigh that had shattered his femur. He lost a lot of muscle and tissue, so he needed skin grafting and also had an external fixator on the leg. He had multiple operations, but he was so distressed by the way his leg looked that he couldn't even look at it. He was doing this silent crying that was heartbreaking, but this is a standard story. Children are psychologically destroyed by everything that's happened. Our colleague Maureen Claire Murphy reported this week that, quote, Israel is abusing UNRWA employees detained in Gaza in order to extract forced confessions against the agency, with detainees describing being subjected to acts of torture. The forced confessions are likely to be used by Israel in an attempt to incriminate UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, Maureen writes. She adds that, quote, Israel is seeking to starve UNRWA out of existence through smears and unsubstantiated allegations aimed at drying up the agency's voluntary funding. Philippe Lazzarini, the head of the embattled agency, told the UN Security Council last Wednesday that Israel continues to block the provision of life-saving aid as part of its insidious campaign to push UNRWA out of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. More than a dozen countries, including top donors US and Germany, froze funding or suspended future support for UNRWA after Israel alleged that 12 of its employees were involved in the October 7th attacks led by Hamas. The allegations were made public by the agency on January 26th, the same day that the UN's World Court stated that there is a plausible risk of genocide in Gaza, Maureen writes. In her report, she adds that UNRWA staff released from Israeli detention told their employer that in addition to ill treatment that may amount to torture, they were, quote, subjected to threats and coercion and pressure during interrogations to incriminate the agency. These, quote, forced confessions against the agency included that the agency has affiliations with Hamas and that UNRWA staff took part in the October 7th attacks against Israel. According to UNRWA, some staff members were, quote, detained during the performance of their official duties for the UN, including while working at UNRWA installations, and in one case during a coordinated humanitarian movement. Detained UNRWA staff were subjected to a litany of abuses, they say, such as beatings, including by doctors, attacks by dogs, and threats of rape and electrocution. The agency said that its employees underwent treatment akin to waterboarding and had guns pointed at them. UNRWA staff also experienced verbal and psychological abuse, threats of murder, injury, or harm to family members, humiliating and degrading treatment, being forced to strip naked and being photographed while they are undressed, and being forced to hold stress positions. For much more, read Maureen Claire Murphy's report, Israel Subjects UN Workers to Torture, on electronicintifada.net. Meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers carried out a two-day incursion last week inside the Nur Shams refugee camp in the northern city of Tulkarem. Our colleague Tamara Nassar reports that during the 54-hour operation, at least 14 Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces, including three children. The Israeli military carried out the operation with domestic intelligence agency Shin Bet and Israel's border police. The invading forces damaged and destroyed homes, commercial stores, roads, and other infrastructure, and left at least 25 Palestinians injured in the wake of the military raid, Tamara reports. Ayed Abu Akhtesh, Accountability Program Director at Defense for Children International Palestine, said, quote, "The Israeli military invasion into Nur Shams refugee camp marks the deadliest days in the occupied West Bank since the Second Intifada." The Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz reported that when the invasion began on April 18th, more than 120 military vehicles carrying dozens of soldiers raided the refugee camp from multiple entrances and checkpoints, including through the Avnei Hefetz settlement, located on the western edge of the northern West Bank near Tulkarem. Israeli troops besieged the camp, as well as several homes within it. Israeli troops occupied several homes, turning some of them into military bases, barracks, and observation points, according to Defense for Children International Palestine. Israeli military reinforcements, including three bulldozers, sealed the camp, trapping residents inside, while others were unable to enter. Throughout the military raid, Israeli troops deliberately prevented ambulances from reaching wounded and killed Palestinians. The human rights group reported the Israeli invasion resulted in widespread devastation, Tamara writes. Haaretz reported that bullets and grenades have left gaping holes in the walls of homes. Fragments of shells and LAU missiles are strewn across open spaces. Israeli bulldozers demolished infrastructure in the camp, damaging electricity, water, sewage systems, and telecommunication networks, leading to power outages during the military raid. Armed Palestinians in the camp confronted the Israeli invaders to protect their community, injuring several Israeli soldiers. John Elmer will have more on the resistance in Nur Shams later on in this broadcast. Earlier this month, the Lemkin Institute for Genocide Prevention issued an active genocide alert over the situation for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, declaring that, quote, "Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians across Palestine." 2 weeks ago, violence against Palestinians in the West Bank accelerated as large groups of Israeli settler mobs launched attacks on more than a dozen Palestinian villages following the disappearance of an Israeli teenager. For much more on the situation in Nur Shams and across the West Bank, read Tamara Nassar's latest reports, Deadliest Days in the West Bank, and Genocide Alert Issued Over Israeli Violence in West Bank, on electronicintifada.net. In Jerusalem last Friday, an Israeli court ordered the release of renowned Palestinian feminist scholar Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian after she was arrested at her home in the Armenian quarter of the Old City. Maureen Claire Murphy writes that Shalhoub Kevorkian, a professor in the Faculty of Law at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, was released by the court on condition that she attend an interrogation and sign a financial guarantee, according to Adala, a group that advocates for the rights of Palestinians in Israel. Maureen reports that, quote, "Israeli authorities reportedly accused Shalhoub Kevorkian, a Palestinian from Haifa who holds Israeli citizenship, of incitement to terrorism over comments she made during an interview on the Makdisi Street podcast. The police claimed in court that Shalhoub Kevorkian had engaged in, quote, serious incitement against the state of Israel by making statements against Zionism and even claiming that Israel is committing genocide in the Gaza Strip. The police, which are under the authority of far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, noted Shalhoub Kevorkian's significant influence and said that they found posters in her home, quote, portraying IDF soldiers as an occupying army. During a court hearing, the state's lawyer pointed to Shalhoub Kevorkian's factual descriptions of Israel's use of lethal force against Palestinians and the withholding of slain Palestinians' bodies, which are returned to their families in degraded conditions, as examples of the professor's dangerousness. The state lawyer also raised suspicion that Shalhoub Kevorkian has ties to Defense for Children International Palestine, a respected Palestinian human rights group that is among several such groups engaged in international advocacy declared as terrorist organizations by Israel. For much more on this story, read Maureen Claire Murphy's report, Court Orders Release of Palestinian Feminist Scholar Arrested in Jerusalem, on electronicintifada.net. And finally, journalists in Gaza are not only documenting the egregious and accelerating war crimes committed by Israeli forces, especially against Palestinian children, but they're also showing us scenes of joy and laughter. So we wanted to also include these two videos in this live stream report today. And that's just some of the news from on the ground in Palestine over the last few days. Please go to electronicintifada.net to read some of our crucial new features by writers in Gaza, now up on our homepage. And you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Ali Abunima. Coming up, we're hoping to hear from a student on campus at Columbia University. We'll also be joined by a professor, Mohamed Abdu, who was censured by Columbia. And we'll get a full update from John Elmer on the latest military developments across Gaza and the West Bank. But first, we have a very special guest, Ali.
Yes, let's go straight now to Gaza. And we're very happy to have back with us our dear friend and colleague, Abu Bakr Abed. Abu Bakr, are you with us? I hope we have not. There he is.
Yes,
hi, Abu Bakr. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you. How are you too?
We're so happy to see you. Abu Bakr, I know that we may only have you for a few minutes because the electricity and the internet may not last. So first, let me just ask you how you're doing, how's your family, what's the situation around you right now?
Well, it's you know, the updates are always usual because, yes, you know, bombings continue, and especially around my area in the southern parts of the territory, the areas there have been, you know, repeatedly targeted by Israeli forces. And yesterday we have been, you know, we've woken up on a very, very explosive airstrike in the same area. So that area in the southern parts of the Al-Balah has been continuously been targeted and attacked, and which bodes badly that probably they're thinking of a military ground invasion or a military ground operation in the area. But yes, also east of the territories in Deir al-Balah, the eastern outer skirts are also being bombed by Israeli tanks, and residential buildings there have been hugely affected and, you know, have been damaged by those bombs and also other airstrikes. At the same time, unfortunate to say that foreign infections have been widely spreading within the community as a result of population, also malnutrition, and, you know, the incapability of the hospitals and doctors to isolate infected cases from others, because, you know, areas are too increasingly overcrowded, because you're talking about thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in just, you know, a few kilometers square, which is absolutely illogical and complicated to do anything for those cases.
It's overwhelming.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to keep up hope and strength and optimism in such a dire situation. But Abu Bakr, when you were on last time, you gave us all a great deal of hope and smile and joy when you told us about something and you promised to come back. But before I ask you to talk about it, I'm going to ask Tamara to play a little video that you sent us a couple of days ago, and then we'll ask you to talk about the video.
Yes, sure. You see hope. This is our yellow rose. It is, in fact, the best thing we have at the moment, because we see hope through it. Despite destruction, despite the truly unbearable circumstances we are living under at the moment, we still seek out hope. We still see hope. We are sending here the message it made, the message of the way from daughter, especially in my area, that we want you to be with us. We want you to have our back always and every time, because we see hope in you. We are sending, and I, Abu Bakr, is sending a message of love, a message of hope to every one of you from Central Gaza and Gaza.
I love that. Abu Bakr, tell us about what daily life is like right now, and you know what it means to take care of that beautiful rose bush right there.
It just, like, you know, it means everything, because it's already the only thing that we can really, you know, that we can really do at the moment, because everything around us is just destruction, it's just despair, as Dr. Ali said. And everything just, you know, bodes badly. There is nothing that you can really acquire, only probably an atom of hope or desire or determination. But yes, Palestinians in Gaza are made of sterner stuff. Palestinians in Gaza feel hope. And as I said in the last live stream I showed up with you here, we are beautiful souls. And even that Gaza is now darkness, bleakness and somberness, and there is no light you can see in Gaza, as a lack of electricity, and that Israeli forces or the occupation has just cut off electricity since the war broke out on October 7th. And Israel, there is an aerial photo I took around 2 days ago, and it just showed that there is no light in Gaza. And there is a far light coming from the occupied territories in Israel, which is not Israel, the occupied Palestinian territories. We are physically in the dark side, but our spirits, our souls are shining on the bright side. This is how we see hope, and this is what we are made of. Because already, you know, I'm in such circumstances. We are talking about more than 200 days of this genocide, but that has gone beyond what the word genocide, you know, means. Because already, when we see people that, you know, I've just been at the hospital today for a very, very urgent case, but I don't want to bring that to you. Yes, it's a normal thing, because you already know that I'm quite struggling with my weak immune system, but it's all fine. Which is already that when you see people, children are sleeping on the ground, on the floor. Mothers are crying out of pain, and at the same time, casualties, injuries are, you know, receiving a treatment on the floor. Blood is splashed on the floor in just a horrifying way, which is absolutely more than criminal. It's just like, you know, I don't know. I have no words, and it's just like, you know, people, I don't know why politicians think it is too much for Palestinians to have one day of tranquility, one day of calmness. It's been a lot. It's been now very, very much on us. That hasn't got to do with innocent civilians in Gaza who are paying or who are sacrificing their lives and everything just for this war. you can't really imagine that people are, you know, are sleeping on the floor, or sleeping, I'm sorry, on the garbage, on the litter. It is very logical that we are being treated as animals. Probably, if you think about it, animals do live a better life because we are, you know, we don't have any means of life. There is no life in Gaza because you're talking about more than 2 million people displaced in tents. We are now in the summer, which means that snakes and lizards get out in tents. For people, you are going to face another humanitarian crisis, that these places are not good for living for these people. So I just want to say that even yesterday, we talked about 2-year-old niece already, that she licks the screen every time she sees the background of ketchup and French fries. Yesterday, there have been more than 20 bombings in Deir al-Balah. Every time a bombing happens, she sobs in pain. She sobs in fear and panic. She's already terrified. She's already, you know, horrified every time, and she starts crying. And just we need to hold her close and everything. We can't deal with this much of trauma. The traumatic picture now in Gaza is absolutely complex and very complex, which we need a very, very urgent solution with. And something very important to tell you, that we are a people that are not extra to this world. No, we deserve life, we teach life, and we just need to make sure that this has to stop as urgently as possible, as soon as possible. We don't want anything more, because it's already enough, just enough.
Abu Bakr, while I was listening to you, by the way, I just want to say, for those who are listening to this program rather than seeing what the video that Abu Bakr sent us, showed us a perfect yellow rose that he had raised and grown in Gaza, and that he told us about on his previous visit with us on the live stream. And I know that that's something that many people found very moving, and I do too. And one of our viewers is asking us, Abu Bakr, we all want nothing more than for this genocide to end and end now. Someone asked, are you seeing the protests, particularly the protests that are sweeping across university campuses in the United States right now for Gaza, demanding an end to this genocide? Are you seeing them?
Yes, I am. And it's really pleasing and delightful. We really salute these people behind these protests. We really salute these protesters. We really want to encourage them to continue, because I think every single protest matters. Every single word against this genocide matters. Dr. Ali, there is something important that people have to know and to listen to very importantly, which is the difference, the core difference between us and the world, is that Palestinians are dreaming to live, while all the world are living to dream. This is the difference. We are dreaming to live as Palestinians, but all the world outside are living to dream. That's the core difference. So instead of going just like, you know, pursuing our dreams and just thinking about what is next, we are really thinking about the next second. Are we going to stay alive or not? Because already there's something very important, which is, you know, already there was a bombing in the pre-dawn around 2 a.m. in the morning, in the pre-dawn. Today, I just said that this has hit, or this hit our house. I didn't know how I'm still alive at the moment and how I woke up, because that was absolutely rattling. Literally, I was sleeping on my bed. My bed was rattling. And the doors just forcefully opened. And then the windows just, like, you know, rattled, and the windows were affected, by the way, so they were broken. And that, what is next? It is a traumatic, it is a traumatizing that you are sleeping. Imagine yourself, you are sleeping and someone bringing up a drill and doing something over your head. How is that going to be for you? You're going to kill him, absolutely. But it is the same thing. It's been 201 days. There are drones buzzing over our heads. There are bombings that are continuing every single second all day. This is absolutely unimaginable. We need people to understand these little details. I know it's quite probably complicated to understand over this context, because I know it's just that you don't live it, but we need people to understand what is behind this genocide. Not only that we have casualties, we have, like, you know, injuries, and that we are being killed, we're being, et cetera, et cetera. No, we want to bring the show to people so that they live the scenes with us. That's what we want. That's what I tell you all the time. No, I'm hopeful, I'm smiling, and everything. Nothing, as I told you, as I promised you, every time, and I will promise you every time. Nothing. You will never ever see me upset. No, I'm smiling all the time. You will never ever see me upset. You will never ever see me sad. No, at all. Nothing will make us so. It's just about that we want people to understand what is it is really like for Palestinians in Gaza. What are they going through at the moment? And what is the thing for them at the moment like? How are they living? How are they eating? How are they, you know, drinking? It's all about just every single detail. We need people to understand that our life has just gone beyond, you know, the badness of a thing, has just gone beyond the rational limits of a bad life. We need people to understand that. We need people to know that Palestinians in Gaza have been going through hell during 201 days in this genocide. And just, we need people to really not sympathize with us, but to stand with us against genocide. We need you to really, really stand with us.
And alhamdulillah, salamtak. It's terrifying to hear how close that bombing was. And
it was 100 meters. It was just 100 meters.
And I hope that nobody was killed, but we know that people are being killed almost every hour in Gaza. And when you describe the trauma of your niece and the suffering and the trauma that she goes through as a young child who can't understand what's going on or why it's happening, and to think that there are a million children in Gaza who are experiencing the same horror that your niece is experiencing, if not much worse, those children who are lucky to survive. And so we so appreciate you being willing to share it so that we can be aware and remember why we're protesting, why we're encouraging people to continue the protest, to never stop demanding an end to this genocide right now. People in Gaza, you, Abu Bakr, your family, everyone around you, you deserve to have a safe, normal life. And it is an absolute crime and a horror that the United States government, the European Union, the German government, and Arab governments, sadly, continue to conspire to allow this to carry on for even another day.
They are liable. They are all liable for this genocide. Everyone is liable for this genocide. It's silent. And just finally, I know it's been, you know, because the circumstances are always changing, and just like it's always getting harder to speak up and to show up with you. It's just like, you know, a difficult matter. But, you know, every time, think about me, that these words of Abu Bakr may be the last. This is not hopeless. No, I'm hopeful. I'm still hopeful. But what I just want you to do and all the time think about is that these people have gone through the most hellish times ever. If you are going to tolerate it at any point in your life, then you should really, really rethink your humanity. This is one of the things we want to say. And by the way, following what you have said, Dr. Ali, we have just like a small point that we want to conjure to the audience, we want to bring to the audience, which is talking about the international governing body of sports or of football, FIFA. Already everyone knows about FIFA. There have been more than 200 athletes killed in Gaza, while hundreds have been wounded. Sports facilities in Gaza are 54. Only 7 are still sound. Yet, FIFA hasn't commented on the Israeli aggression on sports in Gaza. Meanwhile, Ukraine, when it was invaded back in 2022, FIFA banned Russia, the oppressors, just 3 days after the incident. Again, from an Islamic perspective, you're talking about more than 40,000 people have been killed in Gaza. Already, 99% of them are Muslims, including around 1,000 sheikhs and Islamic scholars. They have been killed. Also, more than 500 mosques have been partially or completely destroyed by Israeli forces. Yet, the International Parliament of Religions in Chicago has not said anything. Again, another thing, which is medical crews, the Gaza Ministry of Health has just announced that more than 450 have medical healthcare professionals have been killed, including doctors and nurses. Also, 520 have been wounded, and almost 26 hospitals have been destroyed by Israeli forces. Only 10 are now minimally functioning. Yet, no one has done, and okay, there has been a condemnation of Israeli forces for that, but already we haven't seen any actions on the ground to ban Israel from doing so. And in central Gaza, only 3 days ago, on April 21st, Al Auda Hospital, which is the second hospital only in central Gaza where more than 1 million people are taking shelter, has been bombed by Israeli tanks. And yes, yet no one is doing anything to stop this genocide. Given these figures to all people, because people do want to know figures, and that this hasn't done anything, hasn't moved them to do so, it is just horrifying and horrible that people are still silent. Again, one final thing, I don't want to just like, you know, it is the internet problem, it is the electricity, it's my pleasure always to talk to you. The good thing is, the yellow rose, there is still, if I wish I could bring that yellow rose, there is another yellow rose on the tree, on the plant. Also, maybe another good thing, we have a yasmin tree.
Beautiful.
Thing.
Well, I hope you'll send us pictures of that too. And these things are a reminder, Abu Bakr, that we always plant things with the hope. When we plant a seed, we look forward to seeing what will grow. So planting is itself a sign of steadfastness. It's an act of hope. It's an act of resistance. It's an affirmation of life. And it's something that we celebrate with you. So thank you so much for that. And before you go, I just want to remind people that in addition to being a wonderful contributor to this live stream and a friend whose face we love to see as often as we can, you're also an incredible writer and journalist. And so we can't get enough of you. And for all those who can't get enough of you, they can read your articles at the Electronic Intifada. There you see Abu Bakr's author page, and you'll see what a fantastic journalist he is. And Abu Bakr, I hope you will write something for us again soon, because writing too is an act of resistance. And with your writing, you also deliver the message and help to motivate people to continue demanding an end to this genocide.
You are the echo of our voices. We will always continue with you being around. We will never ever stop. And there is something I always wanted to tell you live, but it's just like I keep forgetting about it. It is behind Nora this time. It's not behind you, Dr. Ali. which is, I need that AI Christ once we meet.
Absolutely.
You will get all of them. I promise you. You get all our stickers, everything. They're all for you.
Wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. Every time it's just like, you know, you say it, I need that. But there's no way I can be shy this time. We're already,
no.
Don't be shy.
I'm not a guest.
No, it's all for you.
Absolutely. With pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's my
pleasure.
Thank
you so much,
Rebecca. Again and again. You are our yellow roses. You are our hope. Keep that in your mind. We will always be yours. I'm already one of yours. I'm already one of your own. And it's just about that. I promise you to keep the same Abu Bakr you have known for a while. It's just like this.
Thank God. Thank God. And we will see you very soon, Abu Bakr. Come and join us again.
Inshallah. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks, bye-bye.
Friends.
And much love to you and everyone around you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, it's always so, so good and so hard seeing him. So glad that we could make that connection today.
Yeah, we until literally just before he came on, we didn't think we were going to be able to make the connection.
Yeah.
So we were so happy that he could join us.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was talking about, you know, medical workers and physicians and volunteers being killed and the, you know, these like world international bodies of medical associations not saying a word. He's talking about FIFA not saying a word, you know, about all the athletes killed. And I'm also thinking about these universities in the West. Who haven't said
every university has been bombed. And I mean,
every single one.
Abu Bakr, by the way, Abu Bakr, like so many other young people in Gaza, he was a university student.
Yeah.
He is a university student. His education, I mean, even if the war stops tomorrow, there's no university for him to go back to. There's no university for him to continue his studies at, to plan for that future in Gaza. And so it is particularly outrageous, and we're going to be talking a lot about that in upcoming segments, that the universities in the West are not only not standing with their colleagues, their peers in Gaza, but are actually standing against them.
Right, absolutely. So we've been trying to get in touch with students on the campus at Columbia University in New York City, but it's been a little difficult. They're very busy. So we're going to talk a little bit about what they've been up to, and then we're going to bring on Muhammad Abdu, a professor at Columbia, who has been thrown under the bus by the administration. So sustained and militant protests have been organized on campuses across the U.S. and also in Sydney, Australia, in direct opposition to university administration's relationships with Israeli institutions and investments in corporations that aid and abet Israel's genocide in Gaza. Sustained and militant protests have been organized. A wave of encampments on campuses have erupted, beginning with Vanderbilt University in Tennessee several weeks ago and spreading from the East Coast to the West Coast at Ivy Leagues and state universities. But over the last week, students at Columbia University escalated their own protests, bringing tents and banners to establish a liberated zone in defense of students whom the university has criminalized for defending Palestine. This followed Columbia University's president Manoush Shafiq's appearance last week before the House Committee on Education and the Workforce, in which she threw Columbia students and faculty under the bus to appease members of Congress and their efforts to smear anti-genocide protesters as anti-Jewish bigots. On April 18th, in an attempt to quash the expanding protests at Columbia, Shafiq authorized the New York City Police Department to remove and arrest students in the encampments. The university also suspended several students. Here's a video of one student, Mariam Alwan, member of Columbia Students for Justice in Palestine, being arrested by cops. Another student, also named Mariam, was also arrested and suspended. She tweeted that, quote, "For my organizing with SJP, I've been doxxed, chemically attacked by IOF soldiers, smeared online, followed by the NYPD anti-terrorism unit, gotten brutalized by cops, been suspended, evicted, arrested. I am not exaggerating when I say there is nothing they can do to silence us. To be doxxed for Palestine is an honor. To be suspended for Palestine is an honor. To be arrested for Palestine is an honor. When I see that Palestinians in Gaza are telling us to keep protesting, nothing else matters. Everything I do is for Palestine, and I regret nothing." At nearby New York University, the NYPD arrested and released more than 130 people on Monday, including members of faculty who are protecting their students from arrest themselves. On Monday, NYU constructed a plywood wall around an area of campus in an attempt to prevent the protests from spreading. After New York City police arrested and removed students, the protests grew. And for a week now, the encampments have not just remained on campus, but have spread to over a dozen other campuses across the U.S. So we were trying to get a student protester on, but as I said, it was hard to connect, but we'll try to get them on it a later date. But yeah, I mean, here in the Bay Area, we have encampments at UC Berkeley. I think one at Stanford just went off. And then in Northern California, you know, a couple hours north of where I am, students at Cal Poly Humboldt led this incredible, there they go, where they learned, you know, someone was saying on Twitter that these students have grown up in an era where they learned how to do, rehearsals for, you know, active shooter drills, which is a completely dystopian thing and very American, but they're using those skills now to defend themselves against active shooters who are, of course, the cops trying to arrest them and break up the encampments on their campuses. So it's pretty extraordinary to see.
Yeah. And it's also extraordinary that the solidarity has been so strong on the campuses since the beginning of this genocide. Let's yeah. also remember that students at Brown University back right. in February held a one-week hunger strike in yep. solidarity with Gaza. Students at Yale University just ended an eight-day hunger strike. And so yeah. what we're seeing now is the culmination of months of building protest, and yeah. we're seeing an incredible backlash, and that's who our next guest is going to talk to us about. He is Mohammed Abdu, a visiting professor at the Department of Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies at Columbia University, which of course is in New York. He is a former assistant professor of sociology at the American University of Cairo, and he completed a postdoctoral fellowship at Cornell University. Mohammed Abdu is also the author of Islam and Anarchism, published in 2022 by Pluto Press. Mohammed has also been spending time with the students at their encampment on the Columbia University campus. Mohammed, we are really pleased to have you join us right now.
Hi, Mohammed. Oh, I think you're muted. Yes.
Alaykum. It's an honor to be with you, Ali.
Thank you. Thank you, Mohammed. We're going to talk about what has happened to you. But first, I want to ask you, you've been spending a lot of time with the students at the encampment on campus amid continuous threats and acts of violence from the Columbia University administration. Can you tell us what the mood is like there among the students?
Well, first of all, salam alaikum. It's an honor to be with you all. Usually I start any public discussion with Musa's dua, so just allow me that, if you don't mind. Allahumma shrah li sadri wa yassir li amri wa hlul 'uqdatan min lisani yafqahu qawli. Allahumma shrah li sadri, O Creator, may you open thy breast, wa yassir li amri, and make my affairs easy. Wa hlul 'uqdatan min lisani yafqahu qawli, and undo the knot of my tongue such that my speech becomes accessible to those kindly listening. And happy Pesach to our Jewish siblings. And so far as the students, mashallah alayhum, they are resilient, resurgent. They are our beacon of hope, of light. They are our spine and the whip of a tongue that we speak through and with, insofar as values and justice, our compass will seen and turtle island. Yesterday was a very difficult night, I believe for all of us, because of threats insofar as the calling in of the National Guard, riot police, the prospective use of tear gas, and perhaps even bullets. But alhamdulillah, I passed by this morning, and they always fill me with a great deal of resurgent energy. They have electrified faculty. They have been and have provided a great deal of inspiration to all of us. And mashallah, they're very organized, more than a lot of faculty are. So
that's great to hear. And in fact, overnight, the students at Columbia released a statement saying that they had been threatened, as you said, by university administrators with whom they were in discussions, that they would send in the NYPD, the New York Police Department, again, and even the National Guard, which is shocking considering the infamous history of the National Guard attacking student protesters during the Vietnam War and killing three students at Kent State University in Ohio. And of course, in 1968, the police attacking students at Columbia University. So it really is an infamous history that's being repeated. And now, of course, the person behind these threats and actions is Minush Shafiq, the president of Columbia University. And earlier this month, Muhammad, she appeared before the House Committee on Education and joined hardline pro-Israel members of Congress in attacking you and two other Columbia professors by name, Professors Joseph Massad and Catherine Franke. While the attacks on all of you by the members of Congress and by President Shafiq were outrageous, unfair, false, defamatory, and deeply harmful, what distinguishes the assault on you is that you do not have tenure. While all of you are vulnerable amid this terrifying McCarthyite assault, that does put you in a particularly precarious position. I want to show a clip of the testimony given by President Shafiq in Congress on the 17th of April, and then I'll ask you for your reaction. Let's roll that clip.
Who are supporting terror, and it's not just that case. Let me bring your attention to Muhammad Abdu, who was hired after the October 7th terrorist attack against Israel. He, on October 11th, posted, "Yes, I'm with Hamas and Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad." He also decried false reports accusing Arabs and Muslims of decapitating the heads of children and being rapists. We know that there were decapitations of babies, of innocent Israeli citizens, of seniors, of women. There were rapes. And yet Columbia hired this individual as a professor. How did that hiring process work? Were you aware of those statements before the hiring?
I share with you your repugnance at those remarks. I completely understand that. On my watch, faculty who make remarks that cross the line in terms of anti-Semitism, there will be consequences for them.
What are the consequences?
I have five
cases
at the moment who have either been either taken out of the classroom or dismissed.
And is he one of those?
He will never work at Columbia again.
He has been terminated?
He has been terminated. He has, and not just terminated, but his files will show that he will never work at Columbia again.
So he's currently not employed by Columbia?
He is grading his students' papers and will never teach at Columbia again, and that will be on his permanent
record. How are you?
So, Mohammed, before I ask you, before I go to you, I want to point out that the member of Congress we just saw there, Elise Stefanik, a Republican from New York, actually misquoted you, along with that whole stream of lies about beheaded babies and rapes and so on that regular viewers of this live stream know, just atrocity propaganda and fabrications. But with reference to you, she took a few words out of a long and nuanced text which you had posted on Facebook on October the 11th. In one sentence of that post, you state, and I quote, "Yes, I am with the muqawama, the resistance, be it Hamas and Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad, but up to a point, given ultimate differences over our ethical, political commitments. That's the difference between a strategy and a tactic too," end quote. So, Mohammed, what is your reaction to how President Shafiq responded to Representative Stefanik's attack on you?
Thank you, Ali. Well, clearly it was feckless. Was asinine. The reality of the matter is Shafiq lied on several counts. Number one, I am not terminated. My contract is coming to an end in E3. Number two, I was not hired in October. I was hired in May of last year. While I was just wrapping up my postdoctoral fellowship as well as visiting scholar position at Cornell University. And it is rather quite astonishing, you know, the blasé claims with regards to when executive decisions that really undermine any kind of bureaucratic recourse, ethical adjudications by scholars who are supposed to be my peers, insofar as the evaluation of my work, of the very context of fact-checking, what it is that I said, all that were surpassed, if you will. And this was an attempt to actually, as a matter of fact, torpedo any possibility for my hiring that was actively being taken by faculty as well as students, given the interdisciplinary nature of the work that I do. And it speaks to a great deal of issues, if you will, that we have in terms of values, in terms of problems, as well as solutions and actions that I think are worthy of sitting down and discussing subversion of First Amendment protected rights, freedom of speech, assembly, religion. As a scholar, I was hired by Columbia to teach, to be critical, to challenge, to be challenged. This is part of my learning and part of my own growth to be actually questioned by my students, and a wide array of different fields. I'm an expert of settler colonial studies. I'm an expert in Islamic and arguably even Jewish studies, queer, gender, sexuality, abolition, and so on and so forth. I wrote my dissertation on Islam and queer Muslims. I have issues with movements that embody authoritarian tendencies, hierarchical tendencies, queerphobic, gender, sexist, commitments or the lack thereof. So these become very vital in terms of my evaluation, whether these movements are so-called Islamist, which is an Orientalist term within itself, or whether these issues exist on the left and within leftist movements. To me, humbly, I say that the reason that I was also targeted is because the argument that I make in my own scholarship, there's 531 years of settler colonialism here on Turtle Island. And this becomes rather key because I work within the historical, material, symbolic, and spiritual context of 1492 globally. What happened with Muslims and Jews in Spain? What happened insofar as indigenous people over here and the ongoing genocide of indigenous people? And what Saadia Hartman refers to as afterlife to slavery projects, anti-blackness, anti-grand laws, schools to prison nexus, and so on and so forth. My experience thus created a chilling effect, both within the academy, in my opinion, but it also applies to a wide array of different workplaces and the general public, which says that if you choose to dissent outside the purview of the mainstream of what is manufactured as consent, you'll be punished, you'll be publicly humiliated, you'll be exposed to character assassinations, Your personal information will be discussed online by power structures in the U.S., which also, of course, extends to non-academic as well as governmental actors. It means that in this particular case, that the powers that be, the architects of animosity, are trying to exacerbate differences that exist between us and benefiting of the very fruits upon which conflict is reared, is given air to, such that we're not able to do what it is that we should be doing, particularly in settings such as the academy. Mm-hmm. So I
wanted you to talk a little bit more about that, about the impact that this McCarthyite campaign has had on your career, on your students, and on this, you know, the idea in general of academic freedom. What is this leading to in your view?
Thank you, Amora. Columbia and the congressional committee's behavior towards me is more than just it's a national trend, yes, but it's even beyond McCarthyism. This is Islamophobia and anti-Muslim and anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian racism. Mm-hmm. It involves, the targeting, the punishing, the repression of students and faculty in the U.S. and elsewhere, because you become marked, blacklisted globally. And this was the idea behind Chafi, the president of Colombia, doing what it is that she did, being attacked online by somebody like Congresswoman Stefanik, through her Twitter feed. And it's a blatant violation. I've had to see, and you've shown, Maryam and other students in the encampment, many other students of mine, being suspended, being arrested, being evicted from their homes, and the destruction of their careers, their lives, for speaking truth to power. But we need to pause at that for a moment, because these are our children. What Mawiyah Abu Jamal says, they are, you know, what come from immortality, and they are the arrows that we shoot towards infinity. But this is the consequences of the absence of fact-checking in a post-alternative fact truth Orwellian world, in which words and their meanings are very much...
Mohammed, sorry to interrupt, but isn't that the essence of a university? I mean, shouldn't a president of a university be the first one to say, I mean... When Shafiq was confronted with those distorted, at best, quotes against you, and also, by the way, against the other two professors, Joseph Massad and Catherine Franke, in the case of Joseph Massad, the other member of Congress, I think it was Tim, I forget his name now.
No, yeah.
Another member, yeah, it'll come back to me in a second. But he offered... Or he read a fabricated quote from that he attributed to Joseph Massad, and instead of saying, you know, I'm sorry, sir, but what you're saying is incorrect, these faculty members did not say the things you're saying, and even if they did, they have a right to speak their minds because we hold freedom of speech and academic freedom to be sacred. She threw you all under the bus, condemned you, endorsed the fabricated quotes, and promised to, as we've learned, because also Professor Massad has responded to her statement, she told lies. In his case, she said that he had been removed from the Academic Review Committee, which was false, but she said that in order to appease these members of Congress. In your case, she lied that you were terminated. I mean, is this what one should expect from the president of what markets itself as one of the world's leading universities?
I do believe that this is what ostensibly, unless we put a stop to the over-policing, the criminalization of our students and faculty, Ali, that this is going to become an ongoing trend. In fact, it arguably already is, whether it's Shafi or whoever is going to come after, as a matter of fact. And the problem is that the student body, faculty, the nurturing space of what it is that we're supposed to do, we're not engaged in the indoctrination of students. We allow our students, to sit down and read and engage various different perspectives from fields of expertise. For them to question, because it assumes also an infantilization of them, as if they're not scrolling through genocides, you know, on phones made from another genocide of copper and cobalt in the Congo, and so on and so forth, right? That they need to question what it is that they see with their eyes, right? And this becomes the issue in so many different respects, and why I refer to the Orwellian moment, the very dystopian moment, right? So the fact that you would bring law enforcement and they were engaged in vicious police brutality, break down the fence, throw our children's belongings in the back alley for the kids to have to go and grab these with the help of professors because they are afraid of being targeted or being questioned or being interrogated. As if, again, funding in the U.S., taxpayers' money or otherwise, should not go to more and elevated issues, particularly insofar as homelessness, particularly insofar as education, particularly insofar as healthcare. But this becomes sort of the crux of the problem, right? The ability to question. Is it an American nightmare, as Malcolm has called it, or is it an American dream? And the piercing of the veneer, of the brochure, of what Columbia proclaims itself, and many Ivy League universities do, and non-Ivy League universities, of what they profess themselves supposedly to be. Look, you can come to Columbia, learn so many languages, and engage in this multicultural liberal sort of discourse of an existence, insofar as a sense of communal belonging with others from all over the world, right, become subject to questioning. And they don't want that interrogated. They don't want the American dream interrogated. Let us sit down and talk about the problems of capitalism or the merits. And the same thing with Marxism and so on and so forth. Whatever it is that may be, let us have dialogue, let us have debate. But they don't want that. And it's ironically being dictated by folks and in that hearing that we're supporting and are supportive of, not too long ago, those who were walking down the streets and yelling, Jews shall not replace us. This is the argument, because somebody like Shafiq, on some level, one would assume that, oh, she's okay with DEI. But the folks on the committee who are against DEI, which is problematic within itself and very limited, and a lot of us have critiqued it and so on and so forth, already have issues, and they're riding sort of the bandwagon of all that.
And so, Mohammed, and by the way, just I want to, Tim Walberg is the member of Congress who falsified the quote from Joseph Massad.
Right.
And I also want to just correct myself, because at the Kent State massacre, I think I said the National Guard killed 3 students. They actually killed 4. And that was on May 4th, 1970, when the National Guard was sent in to attack students protesting against the expansion of the genocidal U.S. Bombardment of Cambodia. I just wanted to correct that. But that also provides a really terrifying context, that even the mention of the National Guard in the context of student protests against a genocide really shows how unwilling the United States is to ever become something other than what it is. We just have a couple of minutes, Mohammed, but I wanted to ask you, the students who are now at the encampment at Columbia and similar protests across the country have specific demands. Columbia, like many American academic institutions, has deep ties to Israel and to Israeli universities that are fully involved in occupation, apartheid, military research, and so on, as well as investments, because remember that these Ivy League universities are, I would say, before they are educational institutions, they are real estate corporations and hedge funds. Mm-hmm. Columbia represents that par excellence with its gentrification and expansion into historically black neighborhoods in Upper Manhattan, displacing people involuntarily and gentrifying their neighborhoods. But it also has a massive endowment that is deeply invested in companies that aid and abet the occupation, apartheid, and colonization, and now genocide in Palestine, mm-hmm. as well as profiting from those crimes. So so the question is, well, can you talk more about Colombia's ties, its material, its economic, its political ties to Israel and Zionism? And can you see a world where we can actually overcome that, and where these institutions are first and foremost what they actually proclaim to be, educational institutions where free thought and questioning and learning is actually permitted?
Thank you, Ali. That's a very important question. The question of divestment becomes quite important as a tactic and as a broader part of a larger strategy, because we're also speaking, whether it's in so far as Colombia, whether it's in so far as where I came from, before that, Zionist Land Grab Cornell, its collaboration with Technion, one of the largest land grab universities, 1 million acres of stolen land, 250 indigenous nations that were displaced. This becomes very important insofar as the context of the question of land back, of settler colonialism here. Because ultimately divestment will serve as a tactic, but then the question is, and this becomes again the crux, how can one achieve a liberated Palestine, a free Palestine, without contending with settler colonialism here, without contending with the fact that we're on Lenape territory here? And this is, I think, what needs a lot of great deal of thinking and planning and strategizing and interweaving insofar as the very story and in the very material realities, the historical realities that we're contending with equally. And these are discussions that I encourage my students, that my students are having, that Indigenous Studies scholars are having, and so on and so forth. I think the most important thing right now and at this moment, and there are many, is obviously to put an end again to the genocide of our people back home, and to think through how that can be achieved in the context of here, because there's an ongoing genocide here. But to also get, again, to get people's hands, particularly those in power, off our students, off our faculty, to establish ways in which, again, overarchingly, and I don't mean to be abstract, by the way, in saying this, but this is part of the problem, because we are talking about the societal problem, and the university is a microcosm of society. It's a society of resistance, not liberation. It's colonial in terms of its formation, in terms of its structure, its hierarchical, and so on and so forth. It's meant to do what it's meant to do as an institution. And it's a society of resistance that way, not of liberation, until we build alternatives to these forms, and that becomes something that's very important when we're thinking about liberation, when we're talking about revolution, when we're talking about different ways of existing in the world, right? And the architects of power that are in place who benefit from the conflicts and strifes and disagreements that manifest within society, right? Because again, what these architects are out to do, whether it's Netanyahu, whether it's Congress, whether it's the president of Colombia, it's to exacerbate the rifts between the students itself, such that we can't sit down and talk about what divestment means, given the investment of real estate corporations as Colombia in the ongoing genocides in Palestine, and the role of the mainstream media, and so on and so forth, in terms of the manufacture of consent. But when we're talking about universities specifically, these are sites of education, so we should be able to educate ourselves. We should be able to organize. We should be able to build solidarity with one another. And particularly as oppressed people, not only in the context of Palestine or in the context of even Colombia. It's beautiful to see these encampments manifest in a wide array of different places. But then we need to connect what intersections exist between Palestine, Kashmir, indigenous people on Torlal Island, black people, our black family and kin, siblings, and what actions we need to take in terms of, as a public, to support our children getting into the streets, being a part of neighborhood educational assemblies, supporting our students and our student movements, demanding that black, indigenous, and people of color traditions and ways of thinking and thought, because this is also at the heart of it, right, be respected in the process of demanding different ways of thinking, of living, of being, of knowing the world. So this is what becomes fundamental insofar as the hub here and disrupting again what Columbia is seeking to sustain from the Board of Trustees, from administrative perspectives, and what, again, a segment of faculty that are trained with specific expertise are trying to cultivate within this environment and more broadly within other universities and institutions that are supposed to be the safest place for our children. And now they are far from it.
Yeah. We just have a minute left, Mohamed Abdul. So finally, I just wanted to ask about your advice to students who are risking arrest and suspension and eviction from student housing, who, you know, or professors, scholars like you who are being threatened by administrations who just want to appease, you know, members of Congress or their donors or the corporations that are that these institutions are invested in. What's your advice in terms of building this movement and supporting each other in this moment?
Thank you, Laura. I think that's a very important question. And I learn a lot from our students. I'm deeply humbled by them. They teach me everything. Without them, I would not have a vocation. And it's the most honorable thing that I could imagine doing as a knowledge keeper, as a knowledge producer. I'm originally an engineer. That's besides the point. I do what I do because I love it and because I walk with them, their journey. And the task of a scholar is not to indoctrinate, and I always tell my students, is to open the purview of the world, for students to make their own decisions, but for them to understand how we can interrelate to one another as a species. What is the role of non-human life in terms of inspiring us? What does the land have to teach us given global warming? Given our Mother Earth. Our Mother Earth has her own timetable and schedule, and she does not distinguish between a freedom fighter, an indigenous land defender, as a Zionist. And that doesn't make her any less rational or reasonable than us. It's just that we have elevated ourselves to the top of the pyramid, despite the fact that our Mother Earth produces the very air that we breathe, the very seeds that fruit into vegetables and all kinds of nourishment that we necessitate for our own survival. But I always tell my students, then let our Mother Earth teach us as we walk along. Let her reveal what in Islam is known as al-ghayb, the unknown. Let us walk with her and ask questions, as opposed to also presume, because we've gone through a lot of experiments insofar as revolutions. But as we have to see that we listen to our Mother Earth the way that we should, and to learn from histories, because we have a great deal of anti-colonial, decolonial, abolitionist movement histories that exist and are in the making, to be humble, to be mature, and to learn to grow from one another. The Zapatistas have a wonderful saying, and they are movements that have been a great deal of inspiration to me, and I always tell our students this. Holding each other's hands, we ask what each of us knows, and this is how we develop that revolutionary horizon together. And this becomes the question. We're on different boats and we're heading towards the same storm. And some would acknowledge that there isn't, or would say this, or proclaim that there isn't even a storm. So the students are asking the right questions. The students dream. And if anything, we need to relearn how to dream dangerously, as our youth are being taken away from us, because the chickens are coming home to roost. Not only in the context, certainly because of everything with regards to Palestine and that has been ongoing. But also when I think of Wadi Al-Fayoum, a six-year-old in Plainsfield that was stabbed 26 times by his landlord, a white landlord that used to play with him, 26 times or 21 times, and was murdered. And his mother was stabbed as well, although, alhamdulillah, she survived, though I can't imagine the anguish of a mother. But what would cause a white landlord that used to play with a six-year-old knock on the door, stab him 21 times? So the chickens are coming home to roost. And we need to think fast about the different future that we would like our children to be raised into, regardless of the political spectrums that we lie upon. But this is why we need to get to know one another and again transcend the animosity that the architects of power, the world of the Abbas, Christ the Manifest in terms of strife and disagreement between us. We need to build movements of below, and we need to remain humble, and we need to think outside the boxes that colonialism and imperialism have inculcated in the world in terms of political, organizing, economic principles for, like I said, close to 531 years. But the students lead. We are here to support them. We are here to be inspired by them. Like I said, and we started the conversation, they have electrified the faculty, and I'm very grateful that they have done so. And inshallah, that will continue, and inshallah, we will continue to have their back, because that is our responsibility. We're not doing them a favor. They're the ones that are doing us a favor, because they're holding on to our busala, our compass, in terms of our values in Philistine, in Turtle Island, for the liberation of Africa, Africa the size of the U.S., Canada, Japan, Western Europe, as well as China. That's how big. So we need to think about all these dimensions. Yeah.
We definitely do. And we also need the liberation of Europe from the grip of its genocidal. Of course, I'm not talking about ordinary people who are protesting across Europe, but European elites who are in the grip of a genocidal frenzy that has now lasted more than 500 years and shows no signs of abating when you look at the behavior of the European government and their support for this genocide. But Muhammad, thank you so much for your time today. We hope to have you back, and hope you will keep us up to date on your fight to preserve your academic freedom and your reputation and the academic freedom of everyone at Columbia as well. We wish you the best of luck, and we will be following what happens next. And as I said, I hope you'll come back again.
Yeah.
It would be an honor, Ya Ali and Nora. Thank you for making the time and the Electronic Intifada and all the incredible work that you have been doing for many and many years. A great deal of love and respect your way. Please remember us and the students in particular in your prayers. And we hold the people of Gaza, Abu Bakr, very close to us, his sweetness, his gentleness. All our siblings everywhere in the world, the dispossessed, you know, the wretched of the earth. So inshallah, may this be the year that Palestine sets us all free, bi-idhnillah. If we listen to her, if we really listen to her in full, so.
Ameen.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Professor Abdul. And you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. That was brilliant.
Muhammad Abdul is courageous. I mean, yeah. if you know, to be attacked like that in Congress by your own university president, and to be willing to speak out and to be willing to continue to stand by your convictions and beliefs is an example for all of us. And of course, we will continue to follow what happens with Professor Abdul and with all of this horrific crackdown at Columbia, whose goal, let's remember, is to make the genocide in Gaza and the complicity of institutions like Columbia and the United States government invisible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They want to stop these uprisings because they don't like the attention that it's giving to Gaza. Incredible. And obviously we'll be continuing to talk about this, but let's bring on John. Hello, John.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi, John.
I got my sticker for Abu Bakr.
We have a whole set of stickers that we print a sticker every year, which we do with the wonderful Alliance Graphics in Berkeley, California.
Great.
And the profits from our sticker, all their profits, as I understand, go to the Middle East Children's Alliance, another Great. Wonderful organization. And we send those stickers out each year to people who've given a donation to the Electronic Intifada. And some people have collected them all over the years. Abu Bakr is getting I'm going to actually frame the whole set for him.
He deserves it all.
I love that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love
That's
it.
What I'm going to do.
I can't wait. We can give it to him ourselves, having a coffee on the beach in liberated Gaza.
That's the goal.
That's right. Well, John, you're going to take a look at videos from the resistance in Gaza and the West Bank over the last week, as well as a series of operation by Hezbollah as the war passes 200 days.
200 days.
It's impossible to comprehend.
Yeah. Well, they're still fighting 200 days on. No signs of abating at all. The news report that Nora did at the beginning captured a lot of the things that I always want to say before breaking down these resistance videos, is that we're covering the ground invasion day by day, hour by hour. But the air war against the people of Gaza continues consistently, no matter how the ground operation is going. They're killing 100 people a day from the air, and it's brutal. The scenes that were found at Shifa Hospital of the mass graves, now we're seeing mass graves at Nasser Hospital. And it's important to remember that both of these operations were what the IDF said were the gold standard of urban warfare. They described the attack on Nasser and Shifa hospitals as the example of the type of raids that they were going to carry out in this period from the buffer zone into Gaza. So even though you've heard that ground troops have, for the most part, left Gaza, the Israelis still intend to raid regularly into Gaza. And Shifa and Nasser hospitals are examples of that, but also in Beit Hanun. So let's look at video number one here, Tamar. This is Beit Hanun, where the Israelis went in last week on a focused raid, as they called it. They attacked the internally displaced people's camp in a UN school and arrested everybody over the age of 14. They operated on the ground for more than a week. Again, we've edited out the key parts of these scenes, but we're looking through a sniper scope here at Israeli forces that believe they're sheltered here to the east of Beit Hanun. We're seeing one of more than 40 Al Ghul sniper rifle attacks. We've edited out the scenes here. So if YouTube's watching, we've edited out all of the scenes. People can use their imagination, but this is a sniper hit that the Israelis admitted severely wounded a Shaldag special forces officer, which is something, again, we've seen with these sniper attacks throughout the war, that Qassam, this is a Qassam attack, Qassam is able to track these units and are picking not the regular grunt soldiers, but here during the invasion of Beit Hanun, they're able, according to Israeli confirmation, to target a Shaldag special forces officer. And this is a special forces soldier whose Air Force reconnaissance, and they're feted within the military as being able to move behind enemy lines. And here we see the Qassam brigades are able to target them, and not just any soldier, but to pick these soldiers. And just to note, during this operation in Beit Hanun, the Israelis also released information where they bragged about that through the 2 months, through the 6 months of this ground war, that they have stolen $7.6 million from homes of people in Gaza. And they said the money was forfeited to the Bank of Israel. So of all of the other things that we've covered on this show, Israel wanted to add stealing money from people's homes to the tune of $7.6 million have been taken throughout the course of this battle. So maybe we could go to number two here, Tamara. So that was the first one in Beit Hanun. This is now in the middle camps area. We're seeing a D9 armored bulldozer here with the red triangle over top of it being hit by...
Welcome back. And that was a briefing from Electronic Intifada. Last part dealt with the ongoing resistance that is taking place in Gaza. Before that, a very detailed discussion on the demonstrations at Columbia University and other universities throughout the United States in solidarity with the Palestinians, demanding a complete disinvestment of assets and resources from those who conduct business or have ties with the racist state of Israel. That's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, April 27th, 2024. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. And if you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And also, if you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you want access to the program, go to the Pan-African Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll close out with the music of Booker Little from the album entitled Out Front. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.